Chapter 4 On Democracy, Redistribution, and the Destruction of Property. Imagine a world government, democratically elected according to the principle of one man, one vote, on a worldwide scale. What would the probable outcome of an election be? Most likely, we would get a Chinese-Indian coalition government. And what would this government most likely decide to do in order to satisfy its supporters and be re-elected? The government would probably find that the so-called Western world had far too much wealth, and the rest of the world, in particular China and India, far too little, and that a systematic wealth and income redistribution would be necessary. The combined population of China and India is around 2.2 billion of a current world population of about 6 billion. By contrast, the combined population of Western Europe and North America is approximately 700 million. Or imagine that in your own country the right to vote were expanded to 7-year-olds. While the government would not likely be staffed of children, its policies would most definitely reflect the legitimate concerns of children to have adequate and equal access to free French fries, lemonade, and videos. During the mid-19th century, the average life expectancy in Western Europe and North America was approximately 40 years. At that time, apart from being restricted exclusively to males, as well as by significant minimum property requirements, the franchise was restricted by a minimum age requirement of typically 25 years. In some places, such as the United Kingdom and Sweden, the requirement was as low as 21 years, and in others, such as France and Denmark, it was as high as 30 years. Nowadays, while the average life expectancy in Western Europe and North America has risen to well above 70 years, the franchise extends everywhere to males and females, all property requirements have been abolished, and the minimum voting age has been generally lowered to 18 years. If the original maturity requirements had been maintained, the minimum age should have been raised instead, from, on the average, 25 years to about 50 years. With these thought experiments in mind, there can be no doubt about the consequences which resulted from the process of democratization that began in Europe and the US in the second half of the 19th century and has come to fruition since the end of World War I. The successive expansion of the franchise and finally the establishment of universal adult suffrage did, within each country, what a world democracy would do for the entire globe. It set in motion a seemingly permanent tendency toward wealth and income redistribution. As a rough indicator of this tendency, one may want to relate successive expansions of the electorate during the late 19th and early 20th century to the rise of the socialist and social democratic voter turnout, and the parallel decline of classical liberal parties. A few examples will have to suffice here. 1. Germany, for the years 1871, 1903, and 1919, the total number of votes cast was 4.1, 9.5, and 30.5 million respectively. The socialist voter turnout was 3, 32, and 46% respectively. The liberal voter turnout was 46, 22, and 23% respectively. 2. Italy. For the years 1895, 1913, and 1919, the total number of votes was 1.3, 5.1, and 5.8 million respectively. The socialist voter turnout was 7, 18, and 32% respectively. The liberal voter turnout was 80, 56, and 35% respectively. 3. United Kingdom. For the years 1906 and 1918, the total number of votes was 7.3 and 21.4 million respectively. The socialist voter turnout was 5 and 21% respectively. The liberal voter turnout was 49 and 25% respectively. 4. Sweden. For the years 1905, 1911, and 1921, the total number of votes cast was 0.2, 0.6 and 1.7 million respectively. The socialist voter turnout was 9, 28 and 36% respectively. The liberal voter turnout was 45, 40 and 19% respectively. 5. Netherlands. For the years 1888, 1905 and 1922, the total votes cast was 0.3, 0.8 and 3.3 million respectively. The socialist voter turnout was 3, 17 and 27% respectively. The liberal voter turnout was 40, 28 and 9% respectively. One man, one vote, combined with free entry into government democracy, implies that every person and his personal property comes within reach of and is up for grabs by everyone else. A tragedy of the commons is created. The tragedy of the commons refers to the overutilization, waste, or depletion of resources held in common as publicly owned goods. It can be expected that majorities of have-nots will relentlessly try to enrich themselves at the expense of minorities of haves. This is not to say that there will be only one class of have-nots and one class of haves, and that the redistribution will occur uniformly from the rich onto the poor. To the contrary, while the redistribution from rich to poor will always play a prominent role, it would be a sociological blunder to assume that it will be the sole or even the predominant form of redistribution. After all, the permanently rich and the permanently poor are usually rich or poor for a reason. The rich are characteristically bright and industrious, and the poor typically dull, lazy, or both. See on this Edward C. Banfield, The Unheavenly City Revisited, especially Chapter 3. Typically, Banfield explains, poverty is merely a transitory phase, restricted to the early stage in a person's working career. Permanent poverty, by contrast, is caused by specific cultural values and attitudes, a person's present orientedness, or, in economic terms, its high degree of time preference, which is highly correlated with low intelligence, and both of which appear to have a common genetic basis. Whereas the former, temporarily poor yet upward-moving individual, is characterized by future orientation, self-discipline, and a willingness to forego present gratification in exchange for a better future, the latter, permanently poor individual, is characterized by present orientation and hedonism. Writes Banfield, if the latter has any awareness of the future, it is of something fixed, fated beyond his control. Things happen to him. He does not make them happen. Impulse governs his behavior, either because he cannot discipline himself to sacrifice a present for a future satisfaction, or because he has no sense of the future. He is therefore radically improvident. He works only as he must to stay alive, and drifts from one unskilled job to another, taking no interest in his work. He is careless with his things, and even when nearly new, they are likely to be permanently out of order for lack of minor repairs. His body, too, is a thing to be worked out, but not repaired. End quote. It is not very likely that dullards, even if they make up a majority, will systematically outsmart and enrich themselves at the expense of a minority of bright and energetic individuals. Rather, most redistribution will take place within the group of the non-poor, and frequently it will actually be the better-off who succeed in having themselves subsidized by the worse-off. Consider, for example, the almost universal practice of offering a free university education, whereby the working class, whose children rarely attend universities, pay through taxation for the education of the middle-class children. Other examples involving this type of redistribution are farm subsidies, favoring in particular large, wealthy farmers, minimum wages, favoring higher-paid skilled and unionized workers at the expense of unskilled and non-unionized workers, and, of course, all forms of business protection laws, protective tariffs, favoring wealthy owners of corporations at the expense of the mass of comparatively poor consumers. Moreover, it can be expected that there will be many competing groups and coalitions trying to gain at the expense of others. There will be various changing criteria defining what it is that makes one person a have, deserving to be looted, and another a have-not, deserving to receive the loot. At the same time, individuals will be members of a multitude of groups of haves and or have-nots, losing on account of one of their characteristics and gaining on account of another, with some individuals ending up net losers and others net winners of redistribution. The recognition of democracy as a machinery of popular wealth and income redistribution, in conjunction with one of the most fundamental principles in all of economics, that one will end up getting more of whatever it is that is being subsidized, provides the key to understanding the present age. All redistribution, regardless of the criterion on which it is based, involves taking from the original owners and or producers, the havers of something, and giving to non-owners and non-producers, the non-havers of something. The incentive to be an original owner or producer of the thing in question is reduced, and the incentive to be a non-owner and non-producer is raised. Accordingly, as a result of subsidizing individuals because they are poor, there will be more poverty. By subsidizing people because they are unemployed, more unemployment will be created. Supporting single mothers out of tax funds will lead to an increase in single motherhood, illegitimacy, and divorce. In outlawing child labor, income is transferred from families with children to childless persons as a result of the legal restriction on the supply of labour, wage rates will rise. Accordingly, the birth rate will fall. On the other hand, by subsidising the education of children, the opposite effect is created. Income is transferred from the childless and those with few children to those with many children. As a result, the birth rate will increase. Yet then the value of children will again fall and birth rates will decline as a result of the so-called social security system, for in subsidising retirees, the old, out of taxes imposed on current income owners, the young, the institution of a family, the intergenerational bond between parents, grandparents and children is systematically weakened. The old need no longer rely on the assistance of their children if they have made no provision for their own old age, and the young, with typically less accumulated wealth, must support the old with typically more accumulated wealth rather than the other way around, as is typical within families. Parents' wish for children and children's wish for parents will decline, family breakups and dysfunctional families will increase, and provisionary action, saving and capital formation will fall while consumption rises. As a result of subsidizing the malingerers, the neurotics, the careless, the alcoholics, the drug addicts, the age-infected, and the physically and mentally challenged through insurance regulation and compulsory health insurance, there will be more illness, malingering, neuroticism, carelessness, alcoholism, drug addiction, age infection, and physical and mental retardation. For one of the earliest, most profound, and most far-sighted analyses, writing in the early 1920s, Mises described the effects of social insurance as follows, quote, "By weakening or completely destroying the will to be well and able to work, social insurance creates illness and inability to work. It produces the habit of complaining. In short, it is an institution which tends to encourage disease, not to say accidents, and to intensify considerably the physical and psychic results of accidents and illnesses. As a social institution, it makes a people sick bodily and mentally, or at least helps to multiply, lengthen, and intensify disease." End quote. Moreover, Mises proceeds to the heart of the matter and explains why insurance against most health and accident risks, and in particular against the risk of unemployment, is economically impossible. Quote, "The value of health and accident insurance becomes problematic by reason of the possibility that the insured person may bring himself about or at least intensify the condition insured against. But in the case of unemployment insurance, the condition insured against can never develop unless the insured person so will. Unemployment is a problem of wages, not work. It is just as impossible to insure against unemployment as it would be to insure against, say, the unsaleability of commodities. Unemployment insurance is definitely a misnomer. There can never be any statistical foundation for such an insurance." End quote. By forcing non-criminals, including the victims of crime, to pay for the imprisonment of criminals, rather than making criminals compensate their victims and pay the full cost of their own apprehension and incarceration, crime will increase. By forcing businessmen, through affirmative action, non-discrimination programs, to employ more women, homosexuals, blacks, or other minorities than they would like to, there will be more employed minorities and fewer employers and fewer male, heterosexual, and white employment. By compelling private landowners to subsidize, protect endangered species residing on their land through environmental legislation, there will be more and better off animals and fewer and worse off humans. Most importantly, by compelling private property owners and or market income earners, producers, to subsidize politicians, political parties and civil servants, politicians and government employees do not pay taxes but are paid out of taxes, there will be less wealth formation, fewer producers and less productivity and ever more waste, parasites and parasitism. To recognize this important truth, it is only necessary to raise the question, what would happen if all taxes were abolished? Would this imply, for instance, that everyone's income would increase from net after-tax income to gross before-tax income? The answer is clearly no, for something is currently done with the taxes collected. They're used, for instance, to pay the salaries of government employees. Their salaries could not possibly rise if taxes were abolished. Rather, their salaries would fall to zero, which demonstrates that they are not paying any taxes at all. As Rothbard explains, if a bureaucrat receives a salary of $5,000 a year and pays $1,000 in taxes to the government, it is quite obvious that he is simply receiving a salary of $4,000 and pays no taxes at all. The heads of government have simply chosen a complex and misleading accounting device to make it appear that he pays taxes in the same way as any other men making the same income. End quote. Once this has been understood, it becomes obvious why certain groups, such as school teachers and university professors, are almost always and uniformly in favor of higher taxes. They are not thereby generously accepting a greater burden imposed on themselves. Instead, higher taxes are the means by which they increase their own tax-financed salaries. Businessmen, capitalists, and their employees cannot earn an income unless they produce goods or services which are sold in markets. The buyer's purchases are voluntary. By buying a good or service, the buyers, consumers, demonstrate that they prefer this good or service over the sum of money that they must surrender in order to acquire it. In contrast, politicians, parties, and civil servants produce nothing which is sold in markets. No one buys government goods or services. They are produced and costs are incurred to produce them, but they are not sold and bought. On the one hand, this implies that it is impossible to determine their value and find out whether or not this value justifies their costs. Because no one buys them, no one actually demonstrates that he considers government goods and services worth their costs, and indeed, whether or not anyone attaches any value to them at all. From the viewpoint of economic theory, it is thus entirely illegitimate to assume, as is always done in national income accounting, that government goods and services are worth what it costs to produce them, and then to simply add this value to that of the normal, privately produced, bought and sold goods and services to arrive at gross domestic or national product, for instance. It might as well be assumed that government goods and services are worth nothing, or even that they are not goods at all but bads, and hence that the cost of politicians and the entire civil service should be subtracted from the total value of privately produced goods and services. Indeed, to assume this would be far more justified. For on the other hand, as to its practical implications, the subsidizing of politicians and civil servants amounts to a subsidy to produce, with little or no regard for the well-being of one's alleged consumers, and with much or sole regard instead for the well-being of the producers, that is, the politicians and civil servants. Their salaries remain the same, whether their output satisfies consumers or not. Accordingly, as a result of the expansion of public sector employment, there will be increasing laziness, carelessness, incompetence, disservice, maltreatment, waste, and even destruction, and at the same time ever more arrogance, demagoguery, and lies, such as, "We work for the public good." After less than 100 years of democracy and redistribution, the predictable results are in. The reserve fund that was inherited from the past is apparently exhausted. For several decades, since the late 1960s or the early 1970s, real standards of living have stagnated or even fallen in the West. The public debt and the cost of the existing social security and healthcare system have brought on the prospect of an imminent economic meltdown. At the same time, almost every form of undesirable behavior, unemployment, welfare dependency, negligence, recklessness, incivility, psychopathy, hedonism, and crime has increased, and social conflict and societal breakdown have risen to dangerous heights. In the United States, for instance, between 1960 and 1990, the murder rate doubled, rape rates quadrupled, the robbery rate increased fivefold, and the likelihood of becoming the victim of an aggravated assault increased by 700%. If current trends continue, it is safe to say that the Western welfare state, social democracy, will collapse, just as Eastern Russian-style socialism collapsed in the late 1980s. However, economic collapse does not automatically lead to improvement. Matters can become worse rather than better. What is necessary besides a crisis are ideas, correct ideas, and men capable of understanding and implementing them once the opportunity arises. Ultimately, the course of history is determined by ideas, be they true or false, and by men acting upon and being inspired by true or false ideas. The current mess is also the result of ideas. It is the result of the overwhelming acceptance by public opinion of the idea of democracy. As long as this acceptance prevails, a catastrophe is unavoidable, and there can be no hope for improvement even after its arrival. On the other hand, as soon as the idea of democracy is recognized as false and vicious, and ideas can, in principle, be changed almost instantaneously, a catastrophe can be avoided. The central task of those wanting to turn the tide and prevent an outright breakdown is the delegitimation of the idea of democracy as the root cause of the present state of progressive decivilization. To this purpose, one should first point out that it is difficult to find many proponents of democracy in the history of political theory. Almost all major thinkers had nothing but contempt for democracy. Even the founding fathers of the United States, nowadays considered the model of a democracy, were strictly opposed to it. Without a single exception, they thought of democracy as nothing but mob rule. They considered themselves to be members of a natural aristocracy, and rather than a democracy, they advocated an aristocratic republic. Of the American founders, Alexander Hamilton was a monarchist. Likewise, the governor of Pennsylvania, Robert Morris, had strong monarchist leanings. George Washington expressed his profound distaste of democracy in a letter of September 30, 1798, to James McHenry. John Adams was convinced that every society grows aristocrats as inevitably as a field of corn will grow some large ears and some small. In a letter to John Taylor, he insisted, like Plato and Aristotle, that democracy would ultimately evolve into despotism, and in a letter to Jefferson, he declared that, quote, democracy will envy all, contend with all, endeavor to pull down all, and when by chance it happens to get the upper hand for a short time, it will be revengeful, bloody, and cruel, end quote. James Madison, in a letter to Jared Parks, complained of the difficulty, quote, of protecting the rights of property against the spirit of democracy, end quote. And even Thomas Jefferson, probably the most democratic of the founders, confessed in a letter to John Adams that he considered, quote, the natural aristocracy as the most precious gift of nature for the instruction, the trust, and government of society. And indeed, it would have been inconsistent in creation to have formed men for the social state and not have provided virtue and wisdom enough to manage the concerns of society. May we not even say that that form of government is best, which provides most effectually for a pure selection of these natural aristoi into the offices of government? End quote. Characterizing the general attitude of the founders, then, the most appropriate pronouncement is that of John Randolph of Roanoke, quote, I am an aristocrat. I love liberty. I hate equality. End quote. Furthermore, even among the few theoretical defenders of democracy, such as Rousseau, for instance, it is almost impossible to find anyone advocating democracy for anything but extremely small communities, villages, or towns. Indeed, in small communities where everyone knows everyone else personally, most people must acknowledge that the position of the haves is typically based on their superior personal achievement, just as the position of the have-nots finds its typical explanation in their personal deficiencies and inferiority. Under these circumstances, it is far more difficult to get away with trying to loot other people and their personal property to one's advantage. In distinct contrast, in large territories encompassing millions or even hundreds of millions of people, where the potential looters do not know their victims and vice versa, the human desire to enrich oneself at another's expense is subject to little or no restraint. Rousseau's Social Contract, which appeared in 1762, was actually meant to be a theoretical commentary on the political situation in his hometown of Geneva, then an independent city-state of less than 30,000 inhabitants, ruled, in effect, by a tiny hereditary oligarchy of the heads of Geneva's leading aristocratic families in control of the small council and the Council of the 200. Rousseau's appeal to the people and popular sovereignty was intended as an attack on this oligarchy, but by no means as a defense of direct democracy and universal political participation as it is nowadays understood. Rather, what Rousseau had in mind when he wrote in support of the sovereign people were merely the members of Geneva's other political body, the Grand Council, which was made up of some 1,500 members and included, besides Geneva's upper aristocratic crust, also its lower hereditary aristocracy. More importantly, it must be made clear again that the idea of democracy is immoral as well as uneconomical. As for the moral status of majority rule, it must be pointed out that it allows for A and B to band together to rip off C. C and A in turn joining to rip off B, and then B and C conspiring against A, and so on. This is not justice, but a moral outrage, and rather than treating democracy and Democrats with respect, they should be treated with open contempt and ridiculed as moral frauds. Fortunately, despite the relentless propaganda spread by government-funded and controlled schoolteachers, such as democracy means that we all rule ourselves, as well as by celebrated Nobel laureates, such as James Buchanan and his public choice school of economics, such as governments are voluntary institutions just as firms, there is still enough common sense left, both in academia as well as among the general public, to find a sympathetic ear for such criticisms. As for academia, An economist as prominent as Joseph A. Schumpeter would note regarding views such as Buchanan's that the theory which construes taxes on the analogy of club dues or the purchase of the service of, say, a doctor, only proves how far removed this part of the social sciences is from scientific habits of minds. End quote. And as far as the general public is concerned, one can find consolation in the remarks of the great American journalist and writer H.L. Mencken, who wrote, quote, "The average man, whatever his errors otherwise, at least sees clearly that government is something lying outside him and outside the generality of his fellow men, that it is a separate, independent, and hostile power, only partly under his control and capable of doing him great harm. Is it a fact of no significance that robbing the government is everywhere regarded a crime of less magnitude than robbing an individual or even a corporation? When a private citizen is robbed, a worthy man is deprived of the fruits of his industry and thrift. When the government is robbed, the worst that happens is that certain rogues and loafers have less money to play with than they had before. The notion that they had earned that money is never entertained. To most sensible men, it would seem ludicrous. They are simply rascals who, by accident of law, have a somewhat dubious right to a share in the earnings of their fellow men. When that share is diminished by private enterprise, the business is, on the whole, far more noble than not." End quote. On the other hand, as for the economic quality of democracy, it must be stressed relentlessly that it is not democracy, but private property, production, and voluntary exchange that are the ultimate sources of human civilization and prosperity. In particular, contrary to widespread myths, it needs to be emphasized that the lack of democracy had essentially nothing to do with the bankruptcy of Russian-style socialism. It was not the selection principle for politicians that constituted socialism's problem. It was politics and political decision-making as such. Instead of each private producer deciding independently what to do with particular resources, as under a regime of private property and contractualism, with fully or partially socialized factors of production, each decision requires someone else's permission. It is irrelevant to the producer how those giving permission are chosen. What matters to him is that permission must be sought at all. As long as this is the case, the incentive for producers to produce is reduced and impoverishment will ensue. Private property is as incompatible with democracy as it is with any other form of political rule. Rather than democracy, justice as well as economic efficiency require a pure and unrestricted private property society, an anarchy of production, in which no one rules anybody and all producers' relations are voluntary and thus mutually beneficial. Lastly, as for strategic considerations, in order to approach the goal of a non-exploitative social order, that is, private property anarchy, the idea of majoritarianism should be turned against democratic rule itself. Under any form of governmental rule, including a democracy, the ruling class, politicians and civil servants, represents only a small proportion of the total population. While it is possible that 100 parasites may lead a comfortable life on the products of 1,000 hosts, 1,000 parasites cannot live off of 100 hosts. Based on the recognition of this fact, it would appear possible to persuade a majority of the voters that it is adding insult to injury to let those living off of other people's taxes have a say in how high these taxes are, and to thus decide, democratically, to take the right to vote away from all government employees and everyone who receives government benefits, whether they are welfare recipients or government contractors. In addition, in conjunction with this strategy, it is necessary to recognize the overwhelming importance of secession and secessionist movements. If majority decisions are right, then the largest of all possible majorities, a world majority and a democratic world government, must be considered ultimately right, with the consequences predicted at the outset of this chapter. In contrast, secession always involves the breaking away of smaller from larger populations. It is thus a vote against the principle of democracy and majoritarianism. The further the process of secession proceeds to the level of small regions, cities, city districts, towns, villages, and ultimately individual households and voluntary associations of private households and firms, the more difficult it will become to maintain the current level of redistributive policies. At the same time, the smaller the territorial unit, the more likely it will be that a few individuals, based on the popular recognition of their economic independence, outstanding professional achievement, morally impeccable personal life, superior judgment, courage and taste, will rise to the rank of natural, voluntarily acknowledged elites and lend legitimacy to the idea of a natural order of competing, non-monopolistic and freely, voluntarily financed peacekeepers, judges, and overlapping jurisdictions, as exists even now in the arena of international trade and travel. A pure private law society, as the answer to democracy and any other form of political, coercive rule.